Good afternoon to you all. I'd like to start today by asking a question. I presume the answer is going to be yes, except with maybe one exception. Did anyone drive on an interstate highway to get here this afternoon? Could I see the hands of those people who drove on an interstate highway? Just as I suspected, it's everybody except the gentleman sitting in the front row, because he lives a short distance from here on a local road. But everybody else, myself included, drove on an interstate highway to get to church today. Now, I'm going to ask you a stupid question. That was an ignorant question. This one's truly stupid. Were the signs written in English or German? Did anyone see any signs written in the German language on the way to church today? Raise your hand if you did. Okay. Well, the fact that you were able to come here in relative comfort on a convenient superhighway, and the fact that the signs were written in English and English, not German, and the fact that you had the freedom to drive here as you desire today is a result of the legacy of two very important individuals of the 20th century. So I want to start out talking about the interstate highway system and how it came to be. Just after World War I, General Pershing, who was at that time the Army Chief of Staff, was concerned about mobilizing the military in time of war, because we had just finished a terrible war, and mobilizing men and materials in the result of in the case of a national disaster or catastrophe. And he was concerned about how to get men and materials into place, both for defense and for security. So he asked a young Army captain to assemble a fleet of 80 vehicles and take them all the way across the country from coast to coast. So this young Army captain got the 80 vehicles and enough men and material to test the Lincoln Highway, as it was called at the time, was the best road that we had. And they started from Fort Meade, Maryland in 1919, and they began driving west just to see how long it would take to get to the west coast with these 80 vehicles. Well, it took them 62 days to drive from Fort Meade, Maryland, which is very close to where our church in Columbia used to meet, Fort Meade, Maryland, to somewhere on the west coast. I don't know where they ended up, but it was somewhere in California, and I guess they got to the Pacific Ocean. But it took them 62 days. The roads were so pathetic at that time compared to our standards today. And they averaged a blazing speed of 3.5 miles an hour on that cross-country trip. Well, Pershing wanted Congress to approve the building of an interstate highway system that would facilitate moving materials and moving men across the country. But nothing was done for nearly 40 years because it was presumed at the time that the railroads would be able to handle the burden. Well, I want to talk about this young Army captain. His name, you may be familiar with him. His name was Dwight David Eisenhower. Became president of the United States in 1952. Well, Eisenhower and one other important individual that stand out in my mind. Of course, there were many, many people who contributed to what happened in the 20th century. But in my mind, there are two people that stand out. One was Eisenhower, and the other was Winston Churchill. Because Churchill was an important example of resolute resistance against evil and determination and courage. His determination prevented and inspired the British people and prevented them from capitulating to apparently overwhelming odds in 1939, in the period before the Allies began their military buildup in England in the early years of World War II. He inspired the British to endure any hardship, to make any sacrifice necessary to preserve their way of life and their freedom. So I won't talk at any length about Churchill or about Eisenhower, but we know that these two men were very important figures in shaping the 20th century and preserving our freedom to this day. Well, during World War II, of course, Eisenhower became the general of the armies. He was in charge of the Allied Expeditionary Force that landed on Normandy on D-Day, and he was the chief military officer for the Allies during World War II, and during his time in Germany, he had an opportunity to study the German highway system. You know, the Germans, that Hitler had built a very efficient highway called the Autobahn, and it was a limited access road, two lanes in either direction. And Eisenhower speculated that the Autobahn had helped Germany to continue for an additional 2 years because of the ease with which they could mobilize their forces and their weapons across the country. So he was really, really impressed with the German highway system. And you have to think that this had been on his mind because he had been involved in this project with Pershing years earlier to try to convince Congress to build a superhighway system across this country. So in the course of time, of course, Eisenhower and Churchill helped to defeat the Axis powers and preserve our way of life. And in 1956, during his State of the Union message, Eisenhower proposed that we should construct a super-efficient, modern highway system across the country. Inspired by the Autobahn, he proposed the construction of an interstate highway system to be built in 10 years. So that's why I asked you, nearly everyone in the room drove on an interstate highway system to get here, except one guy that lives in town. And we all have benefited from President Eisenhower's legacy. Today, we have 46,000 miles of interstate highway system linking all the lower 48 states. And the highways are designed and built to accommodate speeds of up to 75 miles an hour in rural areas. And they're safer because they have controlled access, of course. There's no intersections with other roads. The standards are that there would be a minimum of two lanes in each direction. The minimum lane width for an interstate highway is 12 feet. You're allowed to have a maximum of a 6% grade through hilly areas. There are standards for the width of the median strip. It's 36 feet in rural areas. And there are some myths about the construction and the standards of the interstate system. You may have heard that it was mandated that 1 mile out of every five on the interstate system would be a straightaway so that airplanes could land on it. But that's strictly a myth. That's not true. There are interstate highways in all the lower 48 states, and there are also interstate highways in Puerto Rico and in Hawaii. Now, you know, it seems like kind of a contradiction that you'd have an interstate highway system on an island that doesn't connect to anything, but that's the way it is. And even a little stranger is the fact that the only state that doesn't have an interstate highway in it is Alaska. So the fact that Eisenhower and Churchill helped preserve our freedom. It's why the signs are in English and not in German, and why we're not all speaking German and goose-stepping around the country, because of the contribution, because of the legacy of Winston Churchill and Dwight David Eisenhower, the general of the armies and the president of the United States in later years. The legacy of Eisenhower and Churchill is the freedom of Britain and America. And it's called the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System. That's an important part of the legacy of President Eisenhower. And we all are in debt to these two men as we daily benefit from the legacy that they built. These men built an enduring and a lasting and important legacy that millions and millions and perhaps even billions of people have benefited from. Now, wouldn't it be satisfying for each of us in this room to have a legacy such as the one earned by these great men, to have contributed in such a great way to the cause of freedom and to justice, and to have improved the quality of life in your country, for your countrymen, by building a great highway system? Wouldn't it be satisfying to be remembered as the benefactor of humanity, to have improved the human condition, to have preserved peace and freedom? So what I would like to show you today is that every Christian has a legacy, just like the legacy of Eisenhower and of Churchill. But the comparison between the Christian's legacy and the legacies of Churchill and Eisenhower may surprise you. So my first point is that every Christian can and should have a legacy. So let's turn over to the book of Acts to read about an ordinary man. He's not a general. He wasn't a senator. He wasn't a great orator. wasn't famous. He was kind of an ordinary man, a kind of a guy in middle management, who left a legacy to the church. Acts 10, verse 1. This man was a centurion. That is, he was a Roman soldier in charge of a complement of about 83 men. He had to be a man of character. He had to be a man skilled in war. And he had to have certain qualities and traits. But we learn a little more about him as we read in Acts 10. And we know that Luke wrote the book of Acts as well as the Gospel of Luke. And Luke is known as a very accurate historian. And the details in Luke's account give credence to the account. And here's a little detail that I just found out when I was reading about centurions today. Centurion is a man who is in charge of a century. A century is a complement of Roman soldiers. And you might think it's 100, but it was about 80 or 83. So this man, Cornelius, there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion. So he was in charge of about 83 men of a band called the Italian Band. Now, it turns out that every century is this complement of soldiers, the 83 soldiers. Every one of them had a nickname or a name. And the centurion was known by the nickname associated with his century. So Cornelius was probably as well known as the Italian Band as he was Cornelius. That would have been his name, the Italian Band. If you said the Italian Band, you meant Cornelius, a devout man. So he was a godly man, one that feared God with all his house, and which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. And he saw in a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming to him and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he looked on him, he was afraid, and he said, What is it, Lord? And he said unto him, Your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon, whose surname is Peter. He's living with a tanner, Simon, whose house is by the seaside, and he shall tell you what you should do. And when the angel which spoke to Cornelius was departed, he called two of his household servants and a devout soldier of them that waited on him continually. And when he had declared all these things unto them, he sent them to Joppa. So this guy Cornelius was just an ordinary guy. He was not a senator. He was not a general. He was maybe a lieutenant or a captain in today's terminology. But he had a good reputation. He was a God-fearer. He was a generous person. And he was devout. I wondered while I was reading this, is it possible that he appears someplace else in Luke's account? Because there's another centurion mentioned in Luke 7. Let's just turn over there, and this is by no means certain. But these two individuals seem to be somewhat similar character. Luke 7, verse 2, it says, A certain centurion's servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loves our nation, and he has built us a synagogue. So we can't be certain, but it seems like these two centurions at least had something in common. They seem to have similar character traits. So if they are the same, then they were respected not only by God, but by all the Jews and by men in general. And because of his character and his good works, God used Cornelius to open salvation to the Gentiles. You know, God is not inclined generally in his work to use the great. He doesn't use the Churchills and the Dwight Eisenhowers, but he uses the modest and the humble to have a part in his plans. Perhaps somebody like Churchill has a very strong force of character, and I'll read you some things that Churchill said a little later. And it's good to have a man who is strong of character and maybe stubborn and maybe highly opinionated and maybe autocratic and imperious. Sometimes you need, in this world, you need a man like that to fill the role that Churchill filled. But God, I think, is more inclined to use someone of good character who is humble. And that seems to be the kind of character that Cornelius had. And because of his character and because God decided to use him, Cornelius left behind him a legacy, a heritage for the church. And it was through Cornelius that God opened up salvation to the Gentiles. How about Christian women? Can Christian women leave behind them a legacy? Is there a heritage that can be left by Christian women that people who come after them could benefit from? That's what a legacy is. That's what you leave behind, that someone else who comes behind you can benefit from. How about Christian women? Can they leave a good legacy? Let's look at the example, at the legacy of a Christian woman. Acts 9:36. Someone whose example should be emulated. Acts 9, verse 36. It says, there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which is interpretation called Dorcas. So I think Tabitha is perhaps the Greek name, and Dorcas is the Aramaic equivalent, and it means dear, I think. So Luke is giving you her name there in two different languages, which is by interpretation called Dorcas. And this woman was full of good works and alms deeds, which she did. And it came to pass in those days that she was sick, and she died, whom when they had washed, they laid her in an upper chamber. And forasmuch as Lydda was nigh to Joppa, and the disciples had heard that Peter was there, they sent to him two men, desiring that he would not delay to come to them. So Peter arose and went with him, and when he was come, they brought him into the upper chamber, and the widows stood by him weeping, and showing the coats and the garments which Dorcas had made for them, while she was with them. But Peter put them all forth, and kneeling down, he prayed, and turning to the body, said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes when she saw Peter, and she sat up. And he gave her his hand and lifted her up when he had called the saints and the widows, presented her alive. So the fact that this woman was resurrected isn't really important to the story that I'm trying to tell you. Tabitha was full of good works. And when she died, she was missed. It makes me think, you know, if I died tomorrow, would I be missed? Would anybody miss us if any one of us died? But this woman was full of good works. She was a giving person, a trait that she shares with Cornelius. Remember, Cornelius was full of alms deeds, and God had remembered him for his alms and for his prayers. Alms deeds, giving from a merciful attitude. That's what Cornelius and Tabitha had in common. She was a giving person. She used her skills and her talents to serve the congregation. And apparently she focused on filling the needs of the widows. And when she died, she was grieved and she was sorely missed. Now, the fact that she was resurrected doesn't really impinge on the point that I'm trying to make, but Peter came and resurrected her. So both Peter and Tabitha used their resources to add value to the church and to the community. They used their gifts. They used their skills. They used their money. They used their time. They used their resources. They gave. They served. They added value to the body of Christ. And their legacy, part of their legacy is that their good deeds were recorded in the book of Acts to inspire and motivate us. So their legacy, although they died nearly 2,000 years ago, their legacy continues to this day. They continue to be an example and an inspiration for men and women in the Church of God. So today, in this modern age, we can also leave a legacy. How can we do that? Here are some things that our legacy results from. The way we raise our children is an important and an enduring legacy. Let me read you two short scriptures from the Proverbs. These scriptures both indicate that part of our legacy is our children and the way we have raised them. Proverbs 17:6. Children's children, in other words, grandchildren, are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. Proverbs 13:22. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinners is laid up for the just. So, my point is that bringing up our children in our faith is a legacy which should endure for generation after generation and be self-perpetuating. This is an inheritance for the children, far greater than silver and gold, and something much more precious as a heritage for us to hand down to our children and our grandchildren. Bringing up our children in our faith, carefully teaching our children, and being sure that we pass on godly values to them should be our legacy. Now, I've heard it said that our parents were members of the greatest generation. They endured the Depression. They endured and prevailed in World War II. They overcame a lot. My dad, I think I'm a product of the Depression because my dad grew up in the Depression and we never threw out anything or wasted anything. He taught me how to crimp the edge of the toothpaste tube so that you didn't lose the slightest bit of toothpaste. I mean, I have all these virtues that mean absolutely nothing today. I mean, I can squeeze the tube of toothpaste to the last inch. When my dad died and we had to clean out his house, we filled up three dumpsters. I mean, the big long ones that are, you know, almost as long as this room. We threw away things that had broken during the Eisenhower administration and had never been thrown away, just in case they might be useful again sometime. So that generation overcame and endured a lot. You know, my dad landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and we had some visitors who were from France who were in the church, and we were talking about World War II. And I told them that my dad had been in the D-Day in the Normandy invasion, landed on Omaha Beach, and they thanked me, and I really appreciated that. They thanked me for my dad's contribution, and that meant a lot to me. So that generation was a superior generation in terms of what they accomplished, but one thing they didn't accomplish, one thing that generation failed to do, was to pass on their values to the next generation. They failed, and we're the result. And we see the result of that failure all around us. So, carefully teaching our children and being sure that we pass on godly values to them should be our legacy. We need to teach them the importance of doing the same thing for their children. And one of the church's greatest failings in this age, you know, it engendered the creation of YOU and all these programs to try to keep the youth involved in the church. Yet one of the church's greatest failings in this age has been the inability to transmit our Christian values to our children. We must ensure that our values are implanted in the minds of our children. And if we do that, the truth will endure for another generation. It's somewhere in Psalm 100. It said, David says, and your truth shall endure to all generations. And that's part of our responsibility, to make sure that the truth lasts at least until the next generation, and that generation is trained and motivated to pass on those same truths to their next generation, to their offspring. If we are able to do this, our children will be living examples of the value of God's truth and the value of a godly life. This is part of the Christian's legacy, maybe the most important part. We create a legacy when we continue to obey God in spite of the need to sacrifice and in spite of hardship. We create a legacy that people see and appreciate when we obey God despite the consequences. Look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That was an extreme example. But they created an impression in the minds of the Babylonians when they allowed themselves to be thrown into a furnace rather than have to bow down to some false god. Their legacy is the legacy of courage in the face of death and obedience to God despite the consequences. We create a legacy when we obey God and when we follow the truth despite the opposition of friends and family. When you came into the truth, perhaps I know a lot of you are second generation Christians. A lot of us faced a lot of opposition from family and from friends when we started to obey the truth. We create a legacy when we are faithful in doing the things like tithing and keeping the Sabbath despite job conflicts. If you have a conviction that you must keep the Sabbath and your boss knows this, if you allow yourself to suffer consequences as a result of your desire to keep the Sabbath, your legacy is a vastly different one than if you cave in to pressure and compromise your principles and work on the Sabbath. Those are two different legacies that you create depending on how you hold to your convictions, keeping the Sabbath despite job conflicts, although the results immediately might be difficult to cope with. You've created a legacy. The people who have seen you do this understand and they know about your conviction. Enduring in the truth in any kind of adversity without losing faith and God's promise, without losing faith in God's presence in your life, creates a legacy. Enduring hardship is an example that is noticed, and it's an inspiration to the brethren. That is, if you endure hardship for the sake of the truth, that will be a part of your legacy. The example and the legacy that you create, that you leave behind you, may be the inspiration that someone else needs in order to continue. We create a legacy when we serve one another in doing good works and adding value to the body of Christ and to the community. Let's turn over to John 13. In serving God, we create a legacy when we serve God. We create a legacy when we show love to one another. John 13, verse 34. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you. That you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. Showing love for one another creates an enduring legacy. It doesn't take the title. It doesn't take a title or role of leadership to create a legacy. God remembers the contributions of those who serve above those who lead. Now, you might think, oh, Hugh's talking about stuff that's really peanuts compared to saving the free world or building the greatest public works project in the history of the world. Let's compare the legacy that we could build with the legacy of Churchill and Eisenhower. Well, their legacy is purely physical. Eisenhower and Churchill built things in the physical world that will eventually be destroyed and forgotten. Let's turn over to 2 Peter. 2 Peter talks about, in the third chapter, it talks about the day of the Lord, which is the final phase in God's plan. When God is finished, with the physical creation. The physical creation has no future. It's coming to an end. Let's see what Peter says about that. He says, "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. And the earth also, and the works that are therein." And that's the works of Churchill, the works of Eisenhower. Anything that you've built in this life, they'll be burned up. "Seeing that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God," the day of the Lord, the day that John said he was in the book of Revelation. He said all these things happen in the day of the Lord. "Wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements, the very foundation of matter." Peter's probably talking here with the current Greek understanding of what the elements were. They thought that everything was made up of four elements: air, earth, fire, and water. And they thought that anything else could be made from those four elements. Today we understand that there are at least 92 naturally occurring elements, and that the Greeks didn't have that quite right. Nevertheless, what Peter's saying here is that the very foundation of matter is going to be destroyed. "Seeing that all these things shall be dissolved." Anything that's physical is going to be dissolved. In the book of 2 Corinthians, Paul discusses this. He said, "We know that the things that are seen are temporary." Anything you can see, the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, all the things around us, Paul says all that's temporary. That's the contradiction. Anything that we can see, that we can verify exists, that we can touch, that we can feel, the things that we think are solid, the things that we think are real and permanent. Paul says they're all temporary. It's the unseen things, the invisible things that are permanent. He says we should be looking for and hasting to the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved. And the elements, the foundation of matter, is going to melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwells righteousness. And this new heaven and new earth, it's talked about in Isaiah in two places. I'll show you one of them. Isaiah 65, verse 17. Isaiah says, God says to him, "Behold, I create a new heaven and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered or come into mind." The new heaven and the new earth are going to pale into insignificance any wonder that we can see in this earth or in this universe. In the book of Revelation, Revelation 21, verse 4, it says, "God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying. Neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away." And he that sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." That's the new heaven and the new earth. Everything is going to be new. He said, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." So eventually, in the new heaven and the new earth, when none of these things that we have now, none of the things that we see now, will even come to mind, the works of Churchill and Eisenhower will perhaps be forgotten. Certainly all the pain and the sorrow, including World War I and World War II, all that pain, all that suffering will be forgotten, along with the works of Winston Churchill and Dwight Eisenhower. By that time, any remaining fragments of the Eisenhower interstate highway system will be destroyed with the first earth. Those are parts of a physical legacy. Eisenhower and Churchill left a physical legacy. Christians have the opportunity to build a spiritual legacy. We're involved. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 3. We're involved in building something also, not an interstate highway system that's going to be destroyed when the first heaven and the first earth are destroyed. We're involved in building something that will last. We're involved in it with God. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 9 says, "For we are laborers together with God. You are God's husbandry. You are God's building." We are working together with God to build a lasting legacy. In the next verse it says, "According to the grace of God which is given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let every man take heed how he builds on it, for other foundation can no man lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build on this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest." It'll be made clear what kind of work it is, whether he's built something in the physical realm that's temporary or something in the spiritual realm that will last. "For the day shall declare it, because it's going to be revealed by fire." That fire that is going to consume the earth that Peter talked about, that's going to declare whether everyone's work is in the physical realm or in the spiritual realm. And if it's in the physical realm, it won't last. "And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide, which he has built thereon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved." So even the works of such great men as Eisenhower and Churchill will be destroyed with the earth. What we build in the physical realm will not last. Paul's just told us that. That fire is going to try it to see if it's going to last or not. We need to be sure that we are building in the spiritual realm works that will remain throughout eternity. Eisenhower and Churchill's contribution will last in this age. The Christian's contribution, the Christian's work, the Christian's sacrifice, the Christian's suffering for the sake of righteousness will last eternally. The free world is grateful to Eisenhower and Churchill, but God will remember our lasting work for eternity. And the fact that God remembers and gives us credit for and appreciates our work is in Acts 10. Let's go back to Acts 10 and read about what God said about Cornelius' contribution. Cornelius's prayers and the giving that he did. So that we're back in Acts 10 and verse 4, and Cornelius is seeing this angel in a vision. He's afraid, and he says to him, the angel says to him, you know, I don't know what I would give, what I wouldn't give to have an angel come and say this to me. You know, you couldn't, if I had this, you couldn't buy it from me for any amount of riches. The angel said to him, your prayers and your alms are come up for a memorial before God. When I read this, I always think about the king in the book of Esther, Ahasuerus. He had insomnia one night, and he couldn't sleep, so he had them bring in the books and read the accounts of what had happened in the kingdom. And he found out that Mordecai had uncovered a plot against him and saved his life, and he didn't even know about it. So that kind of reminds me of this example. Perhaps God has records of what you have done. And he says, you know, I need a little bit of inspiration. What are my people doing? Come and read, bring the books here. And an angel comes and brings the books and reads out of this book to God so that God has an appreciation for the work and the sacrifice and the love that his people are displaying for one another and for him and for his work. It's incredibly profound. This man's acts had come up as a memorial before God. God wanted to remember this. He wanted to dwell on this. He wanted to meditate on this. This is incredibly profound. This wasn't some great man. This is a middle manager in the army. He's a Gentile. He's unconverted. But his good works received God's attention and God's recognition. And God was thinking about them and mulling over what this guy had done. And he was receiving pleasure from the good work that Cornelius had done. This is the kind of thing that God thinks about. This is the kind of thing that God meditates on. Our good deeds give him pleasure. Cornelius was developing the qualities of character that God wants to develop in his people, and it delights him when he sees it happening. And God doesn't forget our contributions to the family, to the building. This was a memorial in the mind of the Father, something to be remembered, something to be reflected on. And does God take his own advice? Let's turn over to Philippians 4 and verse 8, because God tells us what we should be meditating on. And especially, you know, when we're depressed or when we're suffering or when circumstances are adverse, we need to, you know, Philippians 4:8 is a memory scripture. This is one of the things that you're supposed to do. It says, brethren, finally, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just and are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's any praise, think on these things. And that's what God was doing. He was thinking about the works of Cornelius, which were true, which were honest and just and pure. They were lovely. It was of good report. The man was filled with virtue. He was to be praised for what he had done, and God was thinking about him and about his works. The work of Cornelius came to before God as a memorial, something to be remembered, something to be savored and cherished. God does not, let's turn over to Hebrews 6 now. God does not forget your work. God does not forget what you do. You are building a legacy in the mind of God day by day as you obey him, as you strive to use your skills and talents to add value to the church. Hebrews 6 and verse 10. For God is not unrighteous to forget your work of labor and of love which you have showed toward his name, and that you have served the saints and do serve. That's what gets God's attention. God is not concerned with leaders in the church. He doesn't dwell on the leaders. He's dwelling on the servants. Christ didn't come here to be a leader. He came here to be a servant. And I heard someone say a couple years ago that when Christ came to earth, he clawed his way to the bottom. He did. He said, you know, the kings of the earth, they have servants. And he said, who's greater, him that serves or him that is served? And they said, well, the guy that gets served is greater. He says, yes, but I've come here to be your servant. Christ clawed his way to the bottom. God wants servants. He's not all that concerned with leaders. Anybody can say he's a leader. God is concerned with servants. God's concerned with people who are not afraid to serve. And Cornelius was a servant, and his good works and your good works will be remembered eternally by God. Your good works, your acts of service are a memorial, a legacy. Cornelius and Tabitha have been honored by God and always will be honored. John 12 and verse 26, this ought to be a memory scripture. This is something that I haven't heard emphasized. Christ said, John 12, 26, if any man serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there also shall my servant be. If any man serves me, him will my Father honor. You know, it's amazing that God would honor one of us, or all of us. One of the most perhaps unremarkable men of the 20th century was another president, President Calvin Coolidge. Calvin Coolidge was known to be a very low-key individual. After having served one term as president, he proclaimed that he would not run for a second term. He never said much. It was very difficult to engage him in conversation or to get him to talk. When he had died, one newspaper columnist said, Calvin Coolidge has died. How can they tell? I mean, he was that low-key an individual. One night he was at a dinner while he was the president, and a young woman was sitting beside him. And she said, Mr. President, she said, I have a bet with one of my friends. She said, I bet her that I could get more than two words of conversation from you this evening. And he turned to her and he said, you lose. And that was it. So that was Calvin Coolidge, perhaps one of the most unremarkable men of the 20th century. But I'm going to give you a Calvin Coolidge quote because I think this is profound. We just talked about Christ saying that if any man serve me, him will my Father honor. Honor. So Calvin Coolidge said, men are not honored for what they have received. You know, do we give honor to billionaires? Do we honor them just because they have a lot of money and they can do anything they want, go anywhere they go, don't want to go? They have 30 cars. They have houses that are, the size of small states. We don't necessarily give honor to those kinds of people. We honor men for what they have given. And Calvin Coolidge was right. Men are honored for what they have given. Tabitha and Cornelia were honored for what they gave, not what they had, what they gave. The example of how we live our lives can be an inspiration for Christians and a motivation for those whom Christ is calling, but it depends on what we give. So, what will we give? Will what we give leave a heritage of good? And how could we ensure that we will that our legacy will be a legacy of good? Churchill said, and I think you see a certain amount of arrogance in the statement, but also a certain amount of self-determination, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Churchill said, history will be kind to me, for I intend to write it. And indeed, for the most part, history has been kind to Winston Churchill, and he did write it to some degree. He intended to have an effect and an influence on history. He intended to leave behind him a legacy of good. Do we, as Christians, intend to leave a legacy of good? Are we actively doing something to leave a legacy of good? We really should. When we're gone, what will be left? Nothing but our legacy. Shouldn't we be missed? Shouldn't each one of us be contributing in such a way that our contribution is missed? I would hate to think that I would die and my contribution wouldn't, that life would just go on and nobody would notice. You know, when you get older, you begin to think about these kinds of things. You young people probably haven't got there yet. But you come to the point in your life where you realize there are more days behind you than there are in front of you. So how could we leave a good legacy? What are some of the things that we might do that would leave that would ensure that we would be able to leave behind us a legacy of good? Well, one man wrote that to live a good life, right? This is for the purpose of living, not for the purpose of dying. To live a good life, write your own obituary and live up to it. Let's write our obituary, all right? What would you like people to be saying about you at your funeral? I don't think that this is a frivolous or even a macabre exercise. This is the kind of thing we ought to be thinking about while we're still alive and while we can do something about it. Let's just go around the room. What would you like people to think about you, to say about you at your funeral? Have you thought about that?
That I love God
okay.
with all my heart.
Good one. And I'll just shorten these, that he loved God. Good one.
That I used my gift God gave me.
I used the gift God gave me. I'll just say the gifts, okay?
I watched, witnessed, and mourned.
I watched, witnessed, and mourned. So I watched, I was aware of my spiritual state, I helped spread the gospel, I mourned for the sins of the world. It says, Christ said, blessed are those who mourn. Okay?
That I was a good person.
I was a good person. I heard someone in the back. I didn't compromise. I didn't compromise and I made a difference. I'll just abbreviate that. Anyone else? Remain faithful. Okay. Okay. All right, so we've got so far. He loved God. He used the gifts. He watched, witnessed, and mourned. He was a good person. He didn't compromise. He made a difference. He remained faithful. He obeyed God's word. Do we have any more? See, each one of us needs to make a list like this and write it down. How a list like this contains your values. Nobody said he had a three-figure income or a six-figure income. I've had a three-figure income. Nobody said I had a six-figure income. Nobody said he had a garage full of Mercedes-Benz. Those things don't matter when you're dead, do they? After everything's over, that doesn't matter anymore. You don't care if you made a big salary and if anybody knows it. See if I wrote down anything that's not up here. That's not going to let me find it today. Oh, here we go. How about, he spent much of his time in service to God and the brethren. He was always loyal to his friends. He was always loyal to God's will. Some of these are mirrored in this list that we just made. He was obedient to the truth. He was a dependable friend at all times. He gave of his time and money. He was generous. He was honest. He was dependable. He always spoke the truth. He was courageous in the face of adversity. He raised his children in the fear and the worship of God. He lived a life filled with faith. His family could always rely on him to provide for them. He strove to understand and to use the gifts that God gave him. God regarded him as a trustworthy and a profitable servant. You know, if it would just make my life if an angel would come to me and say to me what he said to Cornelius. These are the kinds of things, these things reflect our values. When you're dead, someone's going to stand up at your funeral and talk about how well you served your values. These are our values. These need to be written down. Each of us needs to make a list. Remember, I don't know who it was, I forget. Someone said, I've lost my place in my notes here, to live a good life, write your own obituary. There it is. Write your own obituary. Write it down. And spend the rest of your life striving to live up to it. What would be the obituary that you wrote? You know, I remember, you remember the cartoon Calvin and Hobbes? Anybody remember that one? I remember one day on the Sunday paper, Calvin's father is working at his office in the weekend. And he's saying to himself, nobody on his deathbed ever regretted that he hadn't spent more time in the office. You know, that's not, that's, when it all comes down to it, it's not that important. Would your boss come to your funeral and say, well, he worked a tremendous amount of overtime? Would anyone say at your funeral, he had a huge house, tons of money, and always had a flashy car? You know, you never hear this kind of thing at a funeral. It's not important. It's really not important when all's said and done. Decide what your values are. Write your obituary. Wouldn't you want your obituary to read like Acts 9 about Tabitha and Acts 10 about Cornelius? As Christians, we have the opportunity to leave behind us a legacy of good works which can be a benefit and an inspiration to God. To God. You could inspire God. Cornelius inspired God. You could have leave behind you a legacy of good works which could be an inspiration to God and to mankind, not just until the end of the world, but for eternity. You know, Churchill had a conviction that he could make a valuable contribution to the world, and he was determined to write history. He had a vision about what he could accomplish and how he would be remembered. Christians need to have a vision about what they can accomplish and how they will be remembered. Christians have the power to make a contribution which will outlast history. And we need to have the same kind of conviction and vision as Churchill. For the legacy that we will leave, it will last forever. So write down the legacy that you desire to leave and dedicate the rest of your life to living up to it.